chapter, the Yalkut Shimoni says that Miriam was given her name because she was born during the 86 final years of the slavery in Egypt, which was the most difficult time. There was a time when they were just considered strangers, and then there was a time when they were slaves, and then there was the inui, the affliction. Miriam was born, the affliction was really only those last 86 years, and Miriam was born during that time, and about that time the Torah says, Vayimararu es chayehim. They made their lives bitter. Bitter to the point that Svarim say that the people chose death over life. And Miriam's name, Miriam, was given because of that bitterness. And I think that not only was her name given to reflect the bitterness, but Miriam's entire character and her deeds teach how one can deal with those bitter, difficult situations. First of all, it's interesting that Miriam's other name was called Pua, as opposed to her mother, Yocheved, who was called Shifra, because they had two different functions as midwives. Shifra was Mishaperes es Havlad. She used to clean off the baby and improve its condition. Pua was called Pua, Rashi says, because she would make noises, coo, at the babies to make them stop crying. If you think about it, there's a fundamental difference between these two functions. Shifra actually improved the situation. Pua didn't make the situation any better. Just made the baby stop crying. In other words, Pua, Miriam, represented the situation, whatever the baby's crying for, she didn't correct. She didn't change him. She didn't feed him. She didn't make the situation better. She just made it be able to cope with it. She cooed at the baby and make him stop crying. So she didn't, she basically represented the idea of make the best of the situation that you have, even if you can't change it. And when did Miriam get her prophecy? She was called, she's referred to as a prophet once in the Torah. Miriam Hanaviya Achos Aram. When the Jewish people came to Yamsuf, and the miracle of the splitting of the sea occurred, and Miriam brought out all the musical instruments, the drums and the cymbals that they had taken out of Egypt, because they had tremendous emun and bitachon that God was going to do miracles for them, and they'd have a day that they would need these musical instruments to celebrate. So with that, they prepared the musical instruments with them in Egypt and took them out with them. That's when she's referred to as Hanaviya, for a nevuah she had when she was a little baby, six years old. She prophesied that her mother would give birth to the Redeemer. And when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, the house filled up with light. And her father gave her a kiss on the head and said, I see that your prophecy has been fulfilled. And then, when they couldn't hide him anymore, 3 months went by, and they had to put him into the Nile, her father slapped her and said, where's your prophecy now? And she was the one who stood there and watched to see what would unfold. Now, Miriam's mida was that she never gave up hope. She never was miyayish. In the most bitter, difficult times, she still saw the future, Geula, as if it was there. That's the concept of not being miyayish. What's yiyush? Hold on, the question until the end. What's yiyush? Yiyush is that, if it's just something you understand, I'll answer it. It's a question.
This is all
midrashim. They're all, the explanation is mine, but the midrashim are the midrashim. What is yiyush? If you lose something, so as long as you haven't given up hope of finding it, if someone else finds it, they have to return it to you. If you've already given up hope, then you've separated yourself from the object. The idea of not giving up hope is that there's still a spiritual connection between you and the thing that you no longer have physically, but Lamaisa, that you will still want to find. That creates a connection that doesn't let it be severed from your ownership. So too, here too, the concept of Miriam not being Miyayish was that she saw the Geula, she saw the good that was going to come in the end as if it was here right now. She never disconnected herself from it. And therefore, she had the same mida of, she had a nevuah of what the Geula was going to be. But it was also her own nevuah, she was only 6 years old. So I found a medrash that says, the medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu became a Navi, he took over Miriam's nevuah. She lost that nevuah, and it emptied out into him, because it wasn't her nevuah. She was connected already to the Geula. So she had Moshe Rabbeinu's nevuah. And when he took it over, he took it over from her. But it wasn't her own nevuah. She connected in so much to the future. And that's why it says that Miriam's mita was chachma. Not lacha. What's a chacham? Ezeu chacham, haroes hanolad. Someone who can see the future as it's already here. That's the power you have to have not to give up hope. To know, to have emun and be talking that there's a good future and to see it as if it's here. And that was the same mita that enabled her to take out the musical instruments when that stage didn't come yet. But she saw it like it's there. She already took the musical instruments. So therefore that brings out what her nevuah was. That's why it also says that Miriam, when she was a child, she was called Pua because when Paro commanded them to kill the Jewish babies, the baby boys, before they were born, Miriam stood up and she said to him, they to you what God is going to do to you, right, in the future for what you did now. And her mother, Paro wanted to kill her. And the mother said, she's a little kid, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Just a kid, the pattering of a kid. But she knew what she was. She, at 6 years old, already saw Paro's punishment at the time that he was committing the sin and he was at the height of his power. Because she could connect in with tremendous emunah and bitachon to what was going to be in the end. And therefore, she had that same midah when it looked like everything was lost, and Moshe, the little baby Moshe, had to be put into the bulrushes, into the Nile. She stood there and waited, because she stood from afar. She could see from afar that there was still going to be a Yeshua. She didn't give up hope. And therefore it says in the Schus that she waited for her brother Moshe, the Jewish people waited for her when she became a Metzora for 7 days. What's the connection? The connection is that at that point in the desert, this is before the sin of the spies. The spies only happened after the Maisa of Miriam. Every delay in the desert was a chance that the Jewish people would give up hope. We're never going to get there. So delaying was not a good thing. Waiting for Miriam for 7 days only was possible because since they were waiting for her, and she was the paradigm of not giving up hope, of always connecting in to the future Yeshua, right, that the Jewish people wouldn't give up hope waiting for her. The waiting would not be a source of negativism because Miriam was such a inspiration and an influence for the opposite. Waiting for her couldn't lead to giving up hope. So therefore, there was, because she waited for her brother, and she became the paradigm, she became the essence of not giving up hope, the Jewish people were able to wait for her later on. That's how I understand that medrash. Now, it's the whole idea of not being miyayish, not giving up hope, and of connecting in, like we're saying, to the future, means that whatever you have, is eternal, because you're always connected in to that eternal good, that eternal finality, which is always good. So that's why you don't give up hope. And therefore, what's it called? Miriam was the one in whose merit the air, the water, came in the desert. Moshe Rabbeinu, in his merit, the man came. In Aaron's merit, the Anani Akavo, the clouds of glory, came. And in Miriam's merit, the air, the well, from which they had water, came. If you think about it, the Anani Akavo were a luxury. You could live without clouds of glory. You can even live without man, because they had other means of food. They had cattle, they had other kinds of food. But water you can't live out with for even a short amount of time. Food you could live with without for an extended amount of time. Water, if you don't have water, you die. So the most crucial thing in the desert was water. And if the Jews didn't have water, there was always a danger they'd give up hope. So Miriam, who was the fountain of hope, was the one who provided the water. And therefore also, because being able to provide the water was because she was always connected in to the future, to the hope of the future, right, which is always there for the Jewish people. Therefore, the air never stopped being. After they left the desert, it says that that well went into the Yam, into the Yam HaGadol or into the Yam of Tveri, I think. Right, into the Kinneret. Into the Kinneret. And it's still there. I was thinking, that's why the Anani HaKavod disappeared completely. So we need a Yontif to remember them, which is Sukkot. The Man disappeared, but not completely, because there's still Man that is being prepared for Tzadikim, for the future, for the Malachim eat Man. So the Man, we still have a Zecher, but not a Torah Zecher, a Rabbinic Zecher. The Lechem Mishnah on Shabbos is a remembrance to the Man. There is no remembrance to the Be'er of Miriam. You know why? Because it doesn't have to remember, it's still around. You only have to remember something that's not here. But because Miriam was able to attach into the future, always, and never let the bitterness and the difficulties of the present stop her, so her schus remained forever. It was an ongoing, eternal thing. So her be'er remained forever. Right? It stopped temporarily when Moshe Rabbeinu had to bring it back, but from that point on, it never went away. It's in the Kinneret. Miriam also was married to Kalev. Very similar midos. What did Kalev do? He jumped into the sea. When everybody else saw the waters as being dangerous, he saw the split waters in front of him and jumped in. So same thing as Miriam. She saw before her always the Yeshua, never giving up hope, as if it was there in front of her. That was the same Mida that Kalev had to jump into the sea. And that's why Miriam was Zocha to Malchus. Royalty came from Miriam, whereas Kohanim and Leviim came from Shifra, from Yocheved. Because like we said, Shifra was able to change the situation and make the situation different. She made the baby situation different. So she had Kohanim and Leviim, who intrinsically are special people. They don't have to do anything to be a Kohen or do anything to be a Levi. You're born. The match of the situation is intrinsically good. Masha'en came Miriam was Zochatev Malchus. Malchus, you're not born a king. You're born with the potential of being in the household of David, that you could be a king. But a king has to be, has to create and use that potential to become the king. Not everybody who's in the household of David is a king. Very few are. But if you reach that potential, you have that potential, whereas others don't. So that's the same thing over here. The matzah is not automatic. You have to do something to reach it, but it's there potentially. Same thing. Miriam was able to see the potential matzah and connect into it, even though at this time the situation was not good. It was bitter. But she could see how it connected in to the future and bring out that potential future, right, and hold on to it until it actually came. And that's why David HaMelech, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayim, Malchus is like the moon. It goes through periods of waning, but it's always going to come back. There's always going to be a full moon. But you have to be able to persevere and to have the hope that even though you're in the stages of the waning of the moon, that there's soon going to be a rebirth and a renewal of the moon, and it's going to eventually come to a full moon. That was Miriam's Mida, and therefore she was Zoche to that kind of Malchus. And also Chur, who was also Moshe Nefesh. Chur saw the reality of the situation of the Ego, and he gave up his life, and from him came Bezalel, who built the Mishkan, which was eternal. All of this emanated from Miriam, because Chur was Miriam's son. So this is therefore what I would say, the Mida of Miriam, her name again representing the bitterness, the worst part of Shibud Mitzrayim, and yet we learn from Miriam how to persevere, how to cope with adversity and difficulty, and even if you can't change the situation, to make the best of the situation and never lose sight that eventually things are going to be okay. That in the end, everything's going to work out, everything's for the good, and if you don't give up hope of that, then you connect into it, then that in itself gives you the ability to cope. That, I think, is what we can learn from Miriam. Yes?
I think that I agree with a lot of things you're saying. One thing that I'm having difficulty is that Miriam had prophecy and we don't.
Yes, but Miriam, like we said, Miriam's prophecy, I don't know if you were here when we mentioned it, was not really her own. She was only 6 years old. Where did she get her prophecy from? What?
What do you mean it wasn't her own?
The Medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu got his prophecy, Miriam's prophecy was taken away. Why is that? She lost. No, she wasn't a prophet the whole time. She was a prophet only when she was a little kid, until Moshe Rabbeinu, she kept it for 80 years. When Moshe Rabbeinu got his prophecy, she lost hers. He took it away. Now, what's the meaning? The meaning is, she really wasn't a prophetess on her own, because she's only 6 years old. But she connected in to the redemption so strongly that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu of the redemption flowed into her. So when he was able to get it, it went away from her. But she basically was holding on to his prophecy in safekeeping, right, as a preface to it. So her prophecy came because of her ability, even as a six-year-old, to have this tremendous emun and bitachon in the future, Geula, even though at this time the times are the bitterest times that they could be. So it's not that her prophecy enabled her to have the Midah, her Midah enabled her to have the prophecy. And I was thinking, I didn't mention it, so I'm glad you asked now so I can mention it, that for that reason, Miriam questioned why Moshe Rabbeinu divorced his wife, because he was a prophet, because we're also prophets, and we didn't divorce our spouses. Miriam could ask that question because she experienced Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. It was the same prophecy. So she could say, but I also had that prophecy. I didn't have to separate from our wife. She understood it. The only thing she didn't understand is that she got the prophecy that Moshe had at the beginning. Moshe Rabbeinu, after the giving of the Torah, or before the giving of the Torah, reached the highest levels of prophecy that were completely different than what Miriam had. She experienced the beginnings of Moshe's prophecy, not their completion. And therefore she asked the question, but I know what that prophecy is like, but you don't really know what it's like when it reaches its completion, as it did by Moshe Rabbeinu.
But also she was single. She was only 5 years old.
That's what I'm saying. She understood from what she perceived the prophecy of Moshe that that wouldn't necessitate you to separate from your spouse. Because Mama's experienced the way we're saying now, that medrash, that when Moshe became a prophet, it took away Miriam's prophecy. The way we explained it is that Miriam's prophecy was not her own. It was Moshe's prophecy that she already connected into way back when she was 6 years old. Because she connected in to the redemption, and part of the redemption was Moshe's prophecy. So she already was connected into all of that, so it flowed through her. That's the idea. But because she was able to connect into it, that's why she got the prophecy. Because usually prophets have to be on a certain level. 6-year-olds are not on that level.
I yesterday was in a shiur of Rav Shlomo Malach, and he said that Dafka prophecy, as prophecy as itself, is a talent, like a sixth sense that a person has. And only when you mess up in your middle that you get the real type of prophecy. But it could be a 3-year-old who brought stories of bigger than 3-year-olds.
Yeah, that's not prophecy. That's a Ruach HaKodesh or something like that a person can have. But real prophecy, that she should be called a Nevi'ah, can't be unless you are Mezachich and the Rebbeinu decides to give it to you. Both things together. Right? But a person not a Chacham, he can have certain levels, a dream, a Ruach HaKodesh maybe. But those are things that a person... And then a person who's misugal for that, right, can then work on himself, reach the levels where he's roy for the function of the given prophecy. Even then, you can't guarantee you'll be a prophet. But in order to have real prophecy, where the Torah would call it nevuah, and Miriam is one of the 7 nevios, that only can come, if you're on the madrega to do it. But Miriam connected in to Moshe Rabbeinu's madrega, that's where she got the nevuah. Seems, I'm not sure, I'm just telling you what it seems from that idea that she lost her nevuah when Moshe Rabbeinu became a prophet, would seem to say that her prophecy and Moshe's prophecy were one and the same, and either one could have it. So when he got it, it was taken away from her. Okay, any other questions on this? If not, we have a few minutes, I'll go into something else in the parasha. It says that Vayigdal Hayeled, the child grew, referring to Moshe Rabbeinu. And then the next sentence it says, Vayigdal Moshe, Moshe grew. The Ramban says the first one was that the child grew physically, matured physically. And the second was Vayigdal Moshe, that Moshe matured to become an Adam Gadol, to become someone who was fit to be called a great person. Now what was the parameters? What were the qualifications that Moshe became a great person? What made him a great person between the time that he physically matured and he spiritually matured? So the Torah says what it was. Vayetze Alechav, he went out to his brothers, Vayar b'sivlosom, and he saw their suffering. Rashi says, what does it mean, Vayar, he saw? Vayar means he was able to relate. He understood their suffering. Noson einav v'libo lios meitzer aleihem. He put his eyes and his heart to suffer with them. That's called greatness. That's called nosei ba'olim chaveru. That means being able to carry the load of someone else, to actually feel what they're feeling, to feel their pain, to understand it, or the opposite, to feel their simcha and to understand it. For that, you have to be a big person. And why is that called big, great? What's the greatness over here? What's the bigness? So I want to explain it the following way. Rav Shimon Shkop asks the following question. He says, on the one hand, we are mandated by the Torah to be concerned about ourselves. We are number one in our concern. a person always has to be first concerned about himself before other people. And the Torah mandates that. If you lose something or you're losing something, your animal's running away. And your father's animal's running away. And your Rebbe's animal's running away. And you can only save one of them. Two are going to be lost. One can be saved. You save your own. If you have money and you need tzedakah, and there are other people who need tzedakah, you take it. You come first. Even your life. You have the means to preserve your life. You have a flask of water, a canteen in the desert. If you drink it, totally, you'll live. But if you share it with somebody else, you'll both die. You drink it. Don't give it to the other person. Don't share it with him. Drink it yourself. So we see from here that the Torah mandates that a person be concerned about himself. Yet the Torah obviously doesn't say it should end with that. Charity may begin at home, it doesn't end at home. So you have to be concerned about other people. So it's a very big conflict how you balance that self-concern with the concerns for others. So Reb Shimon says, if you have the right philosophy, then it's not such a big conflict. Because a person who considers himself from his toes to his head, and everybody else is somebody else, then there's a big conflict between self-concern and concern for all those people out there. But some people understand that their spouse is mamish part of them. Ishto kigufo, bau ki ishto. When they're concerned about their spouse, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern, but it's two bodies. Some people are even bigger than that. They understand their children are an extension of them. When they're concerned about their children, they're not concerned about somebody else. That's self-concern. Some people realize all their relatives are an extension of them. They're their flesh and blood. And when they're concerned about their relatives, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern, and it includes many, many bodies. Some people are bigger than that. They understand that their neighborhood is an extension of them. Their city, their country, all of Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael, Aradim, Zebazeh, all Jews are interrelated, share one soul. So there's only self-concern. There's not me and them. It's all me. That seems to be just semantics because there's still me, this part of me, and there's that part of me. But it's not such a conflict anymore, as is illustrated by the following. The Chiddushei HaRim asked the following question. We know when the stones were fighting, who Yaakov should put his head on, what did God do? He made them all one big stone, and that stopped the fight. Says the Chiddushei HaRim, why did it stop the fight? If the stones were arguing, that means each one individually was big enough to be Yaakov's pillow. So now when God made them one gigantic stone, they were 12 times the size of his head. So his head's going to only go on 1/12 of the stone. Why wasn't it still fighting? Which part should Yaakov's head go on? The answer is once it's all one big stone, it doesn't make a difference. Because if it's on this side and not on that side, it's still the same stone. Right? Does it make a difference if my arm does the mitzvah, my leg, it's all me. So when you consider everybody part of you, then it's just a matter of priority. Which part of you right now should be taken care of? But when it's you and them, then it's a much bigger conflict. Then the question is it me, my self-concern, or someone else? But if it's all me, and it's only which part of me, it's much less of a conflict. And that's called godless. That's what it means to be a gadol, to be great. Because if you're just you, from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, and you can't empathize and really feel that somebody else is part of you, then you're a small person. And the more you can feel the feelings, whether they be a tsar, the suffering, or the simcha of someone else, the bigger a person you are. Because you encompass more. And you need two things. You need you need to intellectually understand the needs and the feelings of others. And you have to do it emotionally, your heart. Either one's not enough. Because if you just have the heart, but you don't know really what the needs are, you just follow your heart, you may harm people by tapping into their needs. Because, for instance, a person comes, a drug addict, and he begs you for money to buy drugs. You're harming him. You don't have the seichel to know that the best thing to do is not give him the money. Give him the money and send him to a detoxification. So you need eyes. You need seichel. But if you only have your intellectual understanding and you don't feel it, then it's also something missing. You need to intellectually understand at the same time to have that feeling. Nasan ena v'libo. It's thinking, Shimon says, that's the meaning of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. In ein ani li mili. If I'm not going to be concerned about myself, then who's going to be concerned for me? I have to be concerned about myself. But kshani li atzmi, when myself is just little me, from my head to my toes, moani, that's not the real ani. A real ani includes everybody. Myself is really an extension, extends to everybody. And I wanted to say there's a hint in the word ani to that. The word ani, me, really should encompass everybody. And it hints, the word itself hints to that. The aleph on the, what's it called, on one side of the letter, the aleph to the left is the individual, one. Aleph is one, individual. That's me as the individual. The yud on the right side of the word is the tzibur, is the community. 10, it's a minyan. Right? The number 10 represents a tzibur, represents the community, represents a minyan. So I have the individual and the community. What's in the middle that connects them, that makes that my ani, that makes that me? Nun. Nun hints to 50 gates of wisdom and 50 gates of purity. One is intellect, the other is emotion. If you have the 50 gates of wisdom and the 50 gates of purity, then you can connect the individual, you, with the communal you, and make that your ani, make that that's what you are. That's your ani, that's your ego, that's your essence. So that's what the word ani represents. The individual, the community, connected in the middle with the nun, which is 50 gates of wisdom, 50 gates of purity that connect the individual and the community and make them one, and to that's my ani, that's what I am.